Hello, Matthew.
How you doing, Mark?
How are you?
How you doing? Pretty good.
Good.
Doing okay.
Good, good. This is Mark Goldberg, UN Dispatch, speaking
Matthew,
with, as always.
Matthew Lee of Inner City Press, inside the United Nations.
So, Matthew, last time we talked, we spent a lot of time going back and forth about Sri Lanka, you know, why there isn't more of an international outcry over what's going on
sure.
there. And my understanding is you have some update for us.
I do have an update, and I'll try to not be too blow-by-blow, but when last we spoke, there was a lot of cloak and dagger about the Security Council even getting a briefing of any kind. Mexico had, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in this... So far this year, the 6 weeks of this year, the Sri Lankan government has been what they call in kind of a final assault on the Tamil Tiger separatists in northern Sri Lanka. And in the course of this, civilians have been trapped, and there have been when last we spoke, the UN was unwilling or unable to estimate the number of civilian casualties. Said, you know, we really don't know anything. Since then, I will say this: not only people there had sent. Numbers that I asked the UN about, and then Human Rights Watch, which, as we'll say later in this, having some more respect for, they came out with this 2,000 figure, 2,000 civilian casualties since the beginning of the year, 5,000 injured. The UN then dispatched John Holmes, the top humanitarian. He did visit the country for 3 days. So this was what was strange, though, is at least the sort of feedback. And again, this is a very contentious issue. So I'll have to say that you hear on the Tamil side, people call it genocide, and analogize it to a variety of things. The government and also some fervent supporters of the government are adamant that anyone that even raises the civilian casualty issue is just helping terrorists. I've been now accused of being a Mossad agent by a number asking if more people were or comparing. Gaza and Sri Lanka. But to make a long story short, Holmes's visit was pretty closely controlled by the government. They took him around. They even translated for him. I mean, I asked and got confirmed that in some of the interviews he did in an IDP camp, he allowed the Sri Lankan minister to do the translation. So people that were there said the translation was, you know, 180 degrees inaccurate. Like a woman said that her son was abducted by the army, and this was translated to Holmes as the son was killed by the Tamil Tigers. So this was, a lot of questions have arisen, and Holmes has actually not come back to New York yet. He went directly to Colombia. But this is, the main part of this update is that today it was confirmed to me by a permanent five member who was in a position to know that tomorrow there is a briefing of the council about Sri Lanka.
And we should say today is Wednesday.
Today is
Thursday. Pardon me, it's Thursday. Tomorrow
yeah.
is
Yeah, no,
Friday,
I'm sorry. I should have dated that on. So this is obvious.
No, that's
it's
fine.
So
by the time you're watching this, this could have already happened.
This could have already happened. I think
we're living in the future.
The thing is that to not to reduce expectations. Here's the irony of it all:
yeah.
is that it literally is. This is sort of the lowest step of council involvement. It's a briefing behind closed doors on humanitarian situation in Sri Lanka. As last time we spoke, it emerged like Russia, and they're not the only ones, but some countries have really tried to keep even this outside of the council. So I have to say it's been quite a process, and in part I have to, you know, even today actually the UN spokeswoman didn't want to confirm that the briefing is taking place. I'll say it's pretty clear that it is, and it's strange. Even one of the UN's political advisors is like, we know it's taking place tomorrow. Why wouldn't they just confirm it? It seems whether it's just kind of incompetence or sort of reflexive secrecy or a real attempt not to sort of rattle the cage with the Sri Lankan government. But unless something overnight takes place, which is always possible, this briefing will take place. And
so if this happens, or I should say if this happened,
sure.
You know, this would be progress, right? I remember we spoke 2 weeks ago. You were decrying sort of the lack of attention that the Security Council is playing to the Sri Lanka issue.
Sure. I mean, yeah, no, I would. I mean, again, I don't want to, and it's not for me. It's just the idea is obviously here I'm very focused on like what the UN does. Now, whether, also one other just factual update, although Ban Ki-moon, when last we spoke, had refused to call for anything sounding like a ceasefire and had said that as long as it wasn't on the council agenda, he couldn't do so.
Mm-hmm.
Monday of this week, right before he went on this trip that he's gone to Africa, he came out of a meeting about Myanmar, and he took four questions, but I made it, you know, my business to that the fourth one be about Sri Lanka, not Myanmar. And he pulled out a piece of paper, and he said, I am calling for a cessation of hostilities. It is imperative that the civilians be allowed to leave. And this was then sort of like various people in the UN were like, you see, we've done it. You know what I mean? So essentially, in it,
so this is progress.
That is
right?
progress. I'm not trying to be
the same thing. You're also decrying the
No, absolutely. And it's not. I also want to be. I mean, it's a bit too much to be. It's not. It's obviously not about like the questions asked and the answers. But the irony is that not the irony. I mean, not to he made that announcement, and there was this sort of. I'm just saying, sort of, you know, what I see here. People from the 38th floor approached me and said, "Okay, you see, we've done it now. Like, sort of like, leave it alone." The next day, the foreign minister of Sri Lanka was quoted as saying, "There's been no call for a ceasefire. Nothing has been communicated to us." What Ban Ki-moon meant is that the Tamil Tigers should lay down their weapons. So the next day I go to the noon briefing and I say, like, you know, is this consistent with what Ban said? And all they would say is, he said what he said. They wouldn't even confirm whether they've, you know, conveyed it to the government of Sri Lanka. Again, I don't mean to be, it definitely was, you know, they feel it was a step, and it was, from a position of saying he couldn't say anything because of the lack of Security Council involvement, it was some motion. There's still sort of a strange, I mean, I'll say, just for example, in the case of Sudan, when he calls for restraint by Sudan, he convenes the ambassador of Sudan, Abdul Halim Muhammad, to his office on the 38th floor and delivers that message, you know? And then they make a point of giving a readout in the briefing. Ban Ki-moon has today, you know, conveyed this to the ambassador of Sudan. So it's sort of, and I think what the people upstairs try to say is that, you know, the Sri Lankan government is sort of uniquely sensitive. And I think, but there are other governments that are very sensitive, right, and shoot back, and, you know, and mouth back. I think the difficulty here is that there's no, in every other situation, for example, Ban even grandstands a bit with Sudan in order to show, you know, the U.S., the U.K., George Clooney, the Enough Project, as which we'll get to, that he's doing this work, which is good. And I think in this conflict, although there's the same, he's trying to make a call to show restraint and have a ceasefire. There's sort of no, and this is where I think he should be more principled and just do it the same, even if he's not under the same pressure on both sides. But in this case, it's true. There's very little pressure. There's very few member states that are saying, like, hey, tell the government of Sri Lanka to slow down or to, you know, respect civilians more. Maybe India, but they would prefer it not be through the UN. The UK, mostly because they have Tamil protesters in the streets of London. So that Foreign Minister Miliband has said, you know, was called to task on one of those, you know, back and forth parliamentarian debates only this week. And he said, don't worry, we're trying to do what we can in New York, but, and this is, I think you'll appreciate this. He said, but it's worse to put forward a resolution and have it vetoed than not to put it forward at all. Which is very strange because the UK is not proposing any resolution here. I mean, that's why I want to be clear. All that's going to take place tomorrow is a closed door humanitarian briefing. Now, probably
But perhaps this is the first step. Right?
No, you're absolutely right. This is
you have to start.
Oh,
somewhere.
Absolutely. No, exactly. That's what I mean. I just mean in terms of like expectations. It's not like, and yeah. I think that's. But I thought it was strange personally that the British, you know, foreign minister, would say, you know, because they're not putting forward a resolution. And also the irony, also just on the side, like the UK was willing to, along with the US, put forward a Zimbabwe resolution in the middle of 2008, which was vetoed. You know, double veto, and they still called the vote on it. So there's sort of to say, like, we're not doing much on Sri Lanka because it would be vetoed, and that would embolden the government, that they didn't use that strategy vis-a-vis, you know, Zimbabwe. Anyway, I don't mean to be too, but those have been the sort of, like, factual. And then just, like, on the ground today, there was a Tamil newspaper editor that was picked up by the police without a warrant to be questioned. I do want to go out of my way, not only because of this, you know, Mossad and other emails I'm receiving, just to say that, you know, the Tamil Tigers have certainly done a lot of bad things. They flew a plane and bombed and injured a lot of people during these last 2 weeks. And just over the course of time, I'm no supporter of their techniques. But as in most other cases, that doesn't mean that it's like open season on civilians. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
So I guess you could say, I mean, I know you could say that's the UN working. It's like pulling teeth, but like, you know, It's strange how, you know, again, there are some situations in which the council just, like, micromanages, and then there's some that are just, I mean, just, look, yesterday there were these Tibetans across this First Avenue all day chanting, you know, wake up, Ban Ki-moon, and trying to get their issue. And as we probably both know, that issue will never make it to the council. It's not even, I mean, no one even, you know.
Yeah.
Because of the
but, you know, I guess, you know, it is kind of interesting to see sort of which are micromanaged. What is it about Sri Lanka, you think, that makes it less sort of receptive to this sort of micromanagement that, you know, and when we say micromanagement, you know, we mean, you know, issues, say, like Burma, where there's, like, a special UN envoy, and I'm sure we'll get to Myanmar mm-hmm. later. What makes a difference is the fact that Myanmar is so internationally isolated that it sort of there's room for sort of the UN to be speaking as sort of one voice.
Right. It's a very good question. I mean, I think first of all, I will say, because I'm sure the Sri Lankan government would say it. Number one, Sri Lanka is a democracy. You know, it's a democracy that's having some problems treating its minorities, in an appropriate way. But it is, I guess, you know, they would say that to analogize them to a military junta is not the case. I also think, I mean, obviously, in the case of Burma / Myanmar, the U.S. and the U.K. and France are you know, this is one of their sort of poster children of human rights abuse, you know, probably for good reason.
Yeah.
But so you have three permanent members of the Security Council that have been for a long time calling for action. You know what I mean? I mean, if you wanted to even personalize it more, some people are saying, I've heard a lot now with the change from Bush to Obama and a recent meeting that was held here on Myanmar, that, you know, like Laura Bush was not it's not her sort of personal. You know, either you can say, like, you know, crusade, or some on the other side would say, like, vendetta. But her personal interest in Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi made it a high profile issue of UN of U.S. foreign policy, higher than it would have been. And I think that there's now
so maybe the answer to the question here, and this is something I think I probably agree with, is that sort of what makes the difference is when a powerful country like the United States mm-hmm. wants to make it a big issue, but doesn't want to. You know, touch it directly. So they try to work through the UN to, as you say, micromanage.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to say. Yeah,
at least here. Yeah. No, I'm just right. like hypothesizing.
Sure. No, I think you're right.
At least, sort of in the Sri Lanka case, you know, there doesn't seem to be much of a sort of American stake.
No, definitely.
In it.
No, and I think there's also the U.S. is because I mean I think and various people have said this, like 9/11 really didn't. Help the Tamil Tiger cause, let's put it that way, in the sense of, like, they had always been viewed as a sort of, like, particularly vicious, but very much as a kind of, like, a, you know, a separatist or national, you know, whatever you want to call it, national defense, national liberation movement. But right after 9/11, that technique was totally, you know, it made it, the U.S., they're willing to be, the U.S. is willing to be sort of hypocritical on, like, for example, you know, the guy that blew up some Cuban planes, remember this one? This is an ongoing issue. But they're willing to sort of bite the bullet and be involved in double standards on that one. But they're not going to defend a sort of an extraneous, you know, it's not like they support even the Tamil Tigers goals. But and so they've very much put them on the list. And every time the U.S. even in the course, the timing was very strange. But in the course of this assault, where really I think like objectively the focus is supposed to be on the civilians, the U.S. Mm-hmm. made some additional, you know. Additions to the Tamil Tiger sanctions list, which the government made much of. I mean, the government of Sri Lanka is constantly pointing to the U.S. Characterization of the Tamil Tigers as justifying everything that they do there. So that's, you're absolutely right. There's that, and there's, I think, in this one, like the U.K., during the course of these 6 weeks, has probably been out, it had to be out in front. And I think it's been sort of kicking and, you know, screaming, but there are a lot of Tamils in the U.K., and so they've been in response to some degree to those protests. They've tried to. They've been the one. They also. I don't know if we said this last time. The U.K. appointed a special envoy, their own special envoy to Sri Lanka, Des Brown, former defense minister. Sri Lanka refused to let him in, barred him from going in. Okay. So that's a. And the U.K., but what's interesting is their approach to Sri Lanka is decidedly different than, to, for example, Myanmar. On Myanmar, they'll say, you know, we condemn the military junta, you know, Tan Shwe must release political prisoners. And in this, it's like Sri Lanka said to them, you're a bunch of colonialists, don't send an envoy. And they said publicly, we're trying to work through this, you know? So they do, you know, in any case, but I think you're right. I think we can zero that. It also takes a No, I think it is. That's exactly what it is. It takes one or more, probably more than one, ideally, P5 country wanting to make it an issue, which in turn, mm-hmm. because, I mean, yeah, so Russia backed up Sri Lanka, and I'm sure China would if push came to shove, but they are both in the same relation to, you know, Myanmar and Zimbabwe, in a sense, you know? But they were willing to, they stepped back. Well, here's the interesting thing. Like, on Zimbabwe, they stepped back to allow it to get onto the council's agenda for humanitarian reasons. But when the sanctions came forward, they both vetoed it. And no one has even really tried. With Myanmar, there's EU sanctions and U.S. sanctions, but there's no like UN sanctions on Myanmar.
So Matthew, last time we talked, you sort of brought up how you're sort of exasperated that sort of activist groups did not sort of make Sri Lanka as big of an issue as, say, they make with like Darfur or with other sort of humanitarian crises. And I know that sort of you received, I don't want to call it pushback, but some of these groups sort of, I think, constructively engaged with you on this.
Some engagement. You saw.
You want to talk about
that? No, sure. And
that?
I think, and I have to. I don't want to be too inside baseball, but I know that you bridge the two sides of this. But I mean, I think the Enough Project, their response. It was just because you'd mentioned them. I didn't mean to single them out as the one and only.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
sort of Africa only.
And on you say like we'll post a link to the Enough Project's response.
Right. The response is that
they wrote that, you know, right. I'm looking at it now. It said sort of the reason that Enough has not taken on Sri Lanka to date is a practical operational issue rather than any kind of value judgment. Mm-hmm. And they go on to say, you know, they're a very new organization. But the response is well worth a read. Sure. And I wanted to know have you, Matthew, like have they reached out to you personally? Not the Enough, but I know sort of GI.
No, sure, and I think the GI Net is much more. They say they have a global scope and that they're willing to. I mean, my whole thought on this was just that. I'll back into it this way, but in sort of. Another human rights paragon came to the UN, I believe last Friday, Mary Robinson, right? She was here for some other purpose, but she did a press conference, so I asked her, like...
Former top human rights official at the UN.
Yeah, absolutely. So I asked her, what's your view? Did you work on this issue when you were human rights commissioner, and what's your view of the current events in Sri Lanka? And she said it's outrageous, you know, and that she tried to work on it, but she it's her belief that the government of Sri Lanka had sort of convinced people that they're almost about to wipe out the Tamil Tigers, so sort of just let them do it. But then she said, she made this analogy, this was the connection. She said, you know, it's not dissimilar to the situations in the DRC or in Darfur. She made that analogy. And I would say a major difference is the other two are very much on the agenda of the Security Council, and are, if we'll use the word micromanagement, I mean, right? There. Anytime something happens these days in Darfur, there will be a meeting of the council convened, and there will be an attempt to put out a press statement. You know what I mean? Saying the government should hold back of Muhajiriya or whatever it is. Same thing on DRC. Yeah. I mean, so which is, you know, I mean, I guess that's as it should be. If the Security Council is supposed to be addressing these not just threats to international peace and security, but humanitarian crises caused by armed conflict, then, I mean, I think, and this is why I would actually, I'd put it this way, there may be reasons in the Security Council that Sudan and DRC are very much on the front burner of the agenda and could come up, you know, several times a month, and Sri Lanka is not. That's why I would say in a perfect world, the NGO community should kind of like hit them where they ain't. You know what I mean? Like, underreported and unacted on humanitarian crises, I would say. I mean,
but then you kind of get almost like a chicken and egg scenario, right? Like a lot of times the NGO communities is the only game in town, right? And they're the ones that bring to light, you know, terrible things going on in Darfur. You know, it was sort of the NGO community at first, and you know, because they had sort of an active presence in South Sudan that brought to light and advocated for Darfur.
Well, no, absolutely, and I give them a lot of credit for that. That's probably one of the only thing is that I think there reaches a point where once you have, like, it's ironic to me when you have the engine of U.S. foreign policy and the NGO community moving in the same direction. Like, personally, I think I would be then the NGO community not should abandon what they've been working on, right? But I hate to say it, like somebody, I don't, you know, and I understand this. I think the difference of opinion is like, it's not true for any particular group. They're free to focus where they want, right? But I think that either as a journalist or whatever, you can step back and say, wait a second, all the NGOs are like you know, they're all on Darfur. Look at this other thing. So it's not, the only way to bring that up is to say, hey, enough project or whatever. Why? Where, I mean, okay, here's a, I'll jump to another topic, not another topic, but you'll see what I mean. As you may have seen, this is a kind of a hype one, but George Clooney, right? George Clooney was traveling in Chad, and there was this op-ed by Nick Kristof where he said the UN had called him up and withdrawn the security, Nick Kristof wrote, speculating that this was because they thought that George Clooney was going to say something, you know, sort of politically incorrect, or if in terms of timing, about President Bashir and the indictment, right?
Yeah.
That was this article. Now, the UN, not only did they sort of publicly, although very gently, right, because George Clooney is an ambassador of peace, for peacekeeping, goodwill ambassador,
yeah,
with this focus on peacekeeping. But also, like, Nick Kristof, I know for a fact that, like, the people at the 38th floor of the UN met for half an hour the day the article came out, about this article, sort of, and there was a lot of grumbling about that it wasn't fair, it seemed kind of vindictive on Nick Kristof's fault part to, like, focus on this one call, and they basically denied that the UN had ever provided any security to the Clooney trip. And to make a long story short, I ran into Sudan's ambassador, which, you know, you're free to discount anything he says. But one thing he did say, which I think is probably true, is that they turned down a visa for George Clooney to Sudan. That's true.
Not surprised.
And that the UN's head of Department of Field Support, Susana Malcora, told Sudan that Clooney's trip was not on behalf of the UN whatsoever. And so the UN's position, I don't even know where I'm going with that, except to say I guess in part I'm also, like, I totally, like, oh, and this, oh, once again, sorry about this. It's been kind of a long week. The connection with this was that...
I see the light bulb.
Yeah, no, I actually have a light bulb today. Hopefully it'll look better. But as to Clooney, this is what the ambassador of Sudan said. He said, where are these people during Gaza? And I thought it was, okay, it's a kind of a snarky G77, you know, Islamic comment. But you know what? It's kind of true. Like, in terms of, like...
What do you mean? There was so much outcry over Gaza.
But are these things...
I spent two whole sessions talking about Gaza.
I'm saying, I think this was his comment specifically as to George Clooney. And I'm certainly not trying to say that it's not a self-serving comment, but it's one that it had a little bit of traction here. But I would go further, because I will say with that, I think that the problem in Gaza wasn't a lack of media coverage. Do you know what I mean? Or a lack of Security Council meetings, because there were many Security Council meetings and there was extensive media coverage, right?
Even
with Israel blocking coverage, the Al Jazeera was there, footage came out.
Right. Then
because of this last, like, whatever it's been now, a month, looking at Sri Lanka, like, there's very little coverage. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not like crying for coverage. In part, it's because the government has been so effective in keeping, you know, the media out and NGOs out. But obviously, if there was a clamor of NGOs, I mean, I don't know. The government of Sri Lanka is very obstreperous. But, you know, Sudan's very obstreperous, too. And yet, you know, you go to Darfur, and there's a lot of NGOs there, you know? I mean, if they were really obstreperous, they'd be like Sri Lanka with northern Sri Lanka. There'd be nobody there. Nobody in the conflict zone. I mean, literally, Medecins Sans Frontières came here.
And the big question on all of our minds is, you know, next, so the International Criminal Court announced that on March 4th, the sort of a decision will be made on whether or not to issue the warrant for Bashir. Chances are, clearly, they're going to issue the warrant. Whether or not it'll be sort of genocide will be one of the sort of things he's wanted for is another question. But chances are on March 5th, Bashir will be sort of an internationally wanted criminal. And sort of the question is what happens on the ground to sort of the humanitarian operation, to the NGOs, to the internationals that are there. Do they get their visas revoked? Are there repercussions visited against them because of the sort of ICC act?
Right.
So this I don't know. This is kind of like something that's been on the top of my
mind. Oh, definitely. It's a big topic over here. Everyone asks, but obviously nobody knows.
And how is it going to affect UNAMID, the peacekeeping operation? You know, we've gone over this like 100 times. I'm very pro ICC action.
Yep.
But I think it behooves those of us who are very pro ICC action to understand that there might be very, perhaps dire near term consequences on the ground, that would result from this.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, no, and exactly. I mean, I guess not for the purposes of being contentious, but I wouldn't be surprised if Sudan made UNAMID, if not more difficult, even threw them out. You know what I mean? I mean, I think, you know, and again, I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase it, but like, you know, if you have an already sort of like us against the world state, right? When you're then when the president of the state is indicted, and I think he's done terrible things. I just want to say to you, there are a number of world leaders that have done terrible things that you don't see being indicted, which doesn't mean he shouldn't be, but that it's the I mean, I've been talking actually to a lot. There are a lot of kind of there not a lot, but there's some Sudanese, you know, staff members that are very well plugged in over there, and you know, many of them hope that they sort of hope that this indictment will make Sudanese power brokers sort of want to jettison Bashir, you know? That's sort of the hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the hope,
like,
but I don't know if that's going to happen. And I think, you know, again, I think we differ a little bit. Like, I like what you say in the sense of, like, you have to take those seriously. And I'm not sure that I've seen sort of Ocampo kind of up close, and it's kind of like, not even grandstanding. We'll have to see how it plays out. I'm very much for the principle that, like, wrongdoers should be brought to justice.
Yeah.
Right, but you got to like.
Yeah.
I also think. I mean, I think to be him, I think that there were several steps to do between going after warlords in the Congo and some relatively low level Sudanese, and then jumping to a head of state.
Yeah.
That was a big jump, and I guess go for the gusto. I think he thought whatever he thought, but I think it also would have looked better if the court had at least some cases that were not in Africa. I guess we'll go back to that one.
I spent a lot of the last. Diablog, yep. talking about this very issue.
We don't have to go over that ground.
I don't know if you know. It was a good one though. It was with a writer for Opinio Iuris, Opinio Iuris, who is a close observer of these issues. Mm-hmm. I wanted to maybe switch gears. I know you've been burning to talk about this. And I confess I haven't read the report, and you are the first person to make me aware of it, but I know you're burning to talk about a new Human Rights Watch report on DRC.
Oh yeah, I mean
I'll serve it up to you like that, because I don't
it's
really
actually,
know
yeah, no, it's I think report. I think in connection with like I mean the and the problem is there have been so many that, you know, as Human Rights Watch brought their you know, their main Congo expert, this woman Annika van Woudenberg, I do want to stop. I think both of us were aware of the work of Alison DeForge, so we should just not say she was like Human Rights Watch's main expert on Rwanda, who perished in that crash in Buffalo. So just I mean, as a it actually, I was thinking in listening to Annika's talk, I was like, there are, you know, I'm sometimes not a skeptic about Human Rights Watch. Sometimes I think like they're in the same way of like. Like they kind of they're running to a Western beat or whatever, but the people that they have are absolutely amazing. You know, I mean, Alison DeForge like was great and rest in peace. But this Annika is incredible, because she basically like so she came. It was a kind of a wide ranging. It was basically to summarize recent reports about the LRA killings in northern Congo, and about recent. You may know that at least on paper, the Rwandan troops being allowed into Congo to chase down Hutu militia, that's supposedly over. There was a ceremony held yesterday to celebrate the departure of the Rwandan troops. Many people are skeptical that they've actually left. But seriously, because they didn't actually complete the job. The FDLR are still around, and according to Human Rights Watch, recently killed 100 civilians in sort of retaliation for having been targeted. So it's all kind of murky, but what it really is that the president of the Congo, Joseph Kabila, is under a lot of pressure, even from his national assembly, to get foreign troops out of the country. So they made a big point of saying the foreigners are all leaving by the end of February. But it's in a strange way, and this is where I give Human Rights, you know, Watch credit for sort of like really, you know, going to the places, getting the names and the numbers. I wish they had better access in like Sri Lanka, because when they do these reports, they really get the numbers. And you know, their thing is sort of like in both cases, the FDLR in the Kivu, you know, Eastern Congo, and the Lord's Resistance Army in Northern Congo, these attacks have kind of like stirred up a hornet's nest, or the word that she used was, you know, it's like wounded lions. But they haven't finished off either group, and both groups are quite vicious and sort of, you know, seek revenge or try to like put themselves back in the news by just killing civilians. So it's hard to to. I thought, I guess, I'll, you know, what was great about an expert like that, I guess I would encourage you while she's here to try to get her on, because she spoke for more than an hour about just down to like the nitty gritty. She called it like the Congo soap opera, and like she's met Nkunda, she's met this guy Bosco, the number two. There was actually, here's an ICC thing for you. There was a screening in Bunia, in Ituri, of the first day of the Thomas Lubanga trial. He was a warlord, one of the first ones now accused of recruiting child soldiers as a crime under international law. So he's been sitting in Hague waiting for a trial for some time, and the trial started recently.
It started just a week and a half ago, I believe.
Ocampo made the opening arguments.
And
to their credit, the ICC, as sort of a, you know, kind of like fresh behind the ears international justice people, they got a church hall in Bunia and put a big screen and wanted to screen it. And I had heard, sort of a skeptic sent me an article that like it all fell apart, that some supporters of Lubanga came and that the screening had to be canceled. She was there, so she said it was very exciting, because there were definitely supporters and detractors of this warlord that attended. You couldn't, it's not like the person didn't have supporters, you know what I mean? I mean, actually, that's always sort of funny in these things. Joseph Kabila himself is quite indictable. You know what I mean? That's all I want to say is I understand that just because justice isn't equal everywhere doesn't mean you don't have to do something. But it does look strange when in the case of the Congo, all of the ones that have been indicted are opponents of the president. And in fact, you almost have the government of the Congo sort of, I feel like they feel they can use the ICC for their own ends. You know?
Right. Well, you know, I don't know. I've actually been trying to follow as best I can this case, and to its credit, the ICC makes sort of they do like these video summaries of like each day's events, and included in the video summaries sometimes are sort of video documentary evidence. Sure. You can see sort of Lubanga, recruiting and training child soldiers.
Some of that footage.
You know, you see Lubanga giving orders to kids with AK-47s in their hands and sort of singing like these sort of songs to get them and to march in unison. And it's chilling, but it's like, I don't know, it's like, to me, almost, it sounds detached to say it like this, but it's intellectually fascinating to watch. Sort of how a like modern day war crimes trial actually works. You have these guys and these, like optically speaking, you have these people, these men and women in these like robes in a really high tech looking courtroom in The Hague, showing video of a field far away, with you know, subtitles and it's, I don't know, it's fascinating.
I've seen, no, and I think it is, again, I don't, it's not to be too much of a skeptic, but I just want to, since she was there, that's what I thought was good. In part, I think the report that I'd seen that somehow the ICC screwed up wasn't quite the truth, but it ended up going to the same place, because the hall wasn't big enough and too many people wanted to see it, and there were, according to her, there were these students, some of whom were UPC or Lubanga supporters, outside the hall saying let them in. They ended up canceling the ICC, and it was run. The ICC was the one doing the screening. They canceled the afternoon session, saying it would be too volatile. Mm. The upshot of it was, though, is that only Ocampo's opening was shown, and the defense opening statements weren't shown, which left a lot of people in the area saying, you know, this is a, you know, it's a propaganda thing. And I think I was glad to hear from her is that it wasn't like intentionally one-sided. It's just that it didn't work out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
But that's again why I give. I mean, really, it was like fascinating because this But I mean, the thing about it, and this is she has traveled up, obviously not in real time when it was taking place, but these murders committed by the Lord's Resistance Army after the Ugandans and the Congolese and the South Sudanese tried to knock them out, and she said it's just in all her and Human Rights' time in the Congo, they never saw anything like it. Literally, like, they did it at Christmas, I guess, to sort of try to send a message, like, never assault us again, or this is what we'll do. They went to churches where people were there for Christmas ceremonies and, like, beat them to death with sticks. They had them, like, calling out to, like, so other people would come to the party, and then they killed those people. So just some outrageous stuff. And the one thing that was sort of, hasn't been sufficiently followed up on was this uncontested New York Times, to their credit, report that the U.S. was involved in funding and planning the assault on the LRA. And I mean, I think it probably is. If you're going to do it, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people are saying the U.S. should get more involved in, like, you know, hunting down or apprehending war criminals. But if you're going to do it, it's crucial. I think that when the U.S. definitely, like, stepped back when it went awry. And I think that, you know, clearly somebody screwed up here in the sense that okay, nobody, I mean, it probably was foreseeable that, like, the day might have been cloudy and you couldn't actually kill the leader of the LRA that day. And it seems pretty uncontested that there were not sufficient precautions taken either by the Ugandans or we can say the UN. The UN has a peacekeeping mission, as understaffed as it always says it is. She said from Human Rights Watch, she said the UN wasn't told about the assault until hours before it began, which lets the UN a little bit off the hook for not being able to protect civilians, but it doesn't let the U.S. off the hook. Why didn't the U.S.?
Well, what's interesting about this U.S. involvement is to me, this seems to be one of the first like things that AFRICOM did. Yep. I don't know how aware viewers are, but over the last year, the United States opened a new command, a new central command for Africa called AFRICOM. Prior to that, Africa, all of Africa, fell under sort of the European command, but now it sort of has its own command. And it's brand new, and then they're saying they're going to sort of try to do things a little differently with AFRICOM. They're going to, I think a civilian is the number two person there, and they're trying to do a little more humanitarian work, some more state building, just sort of try to do more than simple sort of traditional military assistance, but try to add some civilian elements as well, which is all noble and you know, I'm all for, but this was sort of the AFRICOM's first, one of their first big actions, and it seemed to have been a failure. So I don't think it augurs well for this sort of new experiment.
Right. And I think exactly. That's why I also meant there was just sort of a failure to follow up, because it's really striking to me that, like, you know, this idea that and I'm all, you know, I may, when it was said, like, and Doctors Without Borders came out with a report saying that the UN peacekeepers were sitting in their base as people were killed just outside. And I think we
went over that last.
Yeah, that's pretty uncontested. But I mean, with the new, hearing from her pretty much on firsthand, like I really would give a lot of. She knew a number of other things, some of which I'll say in a second. But she said the UN was told hours before it took place, and it really strike. And I, you know, why was that? She said, well, you know, there was a need for secrecy to keep it secret. So does this mean that the U.S. doesn't trust the UN? I mean, we know that it doesn't, but I mean, that's really horrendous. Like, you couldn't tell the head of MONUC, Alan Doss, like, we're going to do this in 3 days' time, you know? Don't tell people why you're moving people there, but move people there. Or, I mean, it just seems...
Well, I mean, listen, it's clear that, this like, mission was a pretty big...
It seems pretty... Right, and I think it...
And I'll reference again, I did this last time, a conversation I had with Julia Spiegel, regular contributor here, and we had a conversation shortly after this operation, and sort of discussed how and why it went awry. So I'd recommend folks who are interested in this check back.
But I guess here's what I want, and then maybe it's because I know that you're such a Susan Rice supporter. I'll say that, you know, since the change of administration and since Ms. Rice has been assigned here, I mean, you know, I've been here. I would have, for example. Clearly, the LRA operation can be sort of blamed on the Bush administration. Like, they did the planning, it fucked up. But I want to say there hasn't been. Maybe it's just a, like.
Well, it happened before
understand.
President Bush was inaugurated.
It still is Obama. Like this is the United States, right? So it seems like it's something that even this idea that, like, sort of like the U.S. is, I think, kind of incongruous position that, like, you know, never again on genocide and full engagement with Africa, and then, oh, but no peacekeeping force for Somalia. Like, I'm willing to hear, like, what the argument is, and I know that you're going to say, well, she made it in the Senate or she's made it elsewhere. Thus far, there really has been the it's not been a kind of an open window. It hasn't been, there haven't been, like, presentations of, like, this is the U.S., this is either the new U.S. position or this is the U.S. position. It's been all very kind of, like, closed door. They did a closed door briefing for journalists off the record. No one can report on it. When they come to the stakeout, they take like two questions and run, whereas, you know, the other ambassadors are like taking pretty much anything that's asked. And I think, so, okay, you know, it takes a while to get up to speed, but I just want to say this to you. If you're here and you're following, I don't know when it is to expect this kind of like new, you know, breath of fresh air that you were, I don't know, predicting.
Oh, I mean, I guess on, like, I don't know sort of where to start, but maybe with Somalia, you know, as, you know, I think we've said before, Rice does object to a new peacekeeping mission for mm-hmm. Somalia. The objection is not, as far as I can tell, because she thinks Somalia like doesn't need it. It's because Somalia, because there's just no international capacity to stand up a kind of force that Somalia requires. Right? It's that there is no will. Like, the U.S. doesn't... And believe me, like, a peacekeeping force for Somalia effectively means invading and occupying mm-hmm. the country. Like, it doesn't... There's no peace upon which to base a peacekeeping mission. It means... it means invading, occupying, and doing, like, East Timor-style state building, but at, like, a much larger level, because East Timor is... A tiny country compared to Somalia.
But I guess what I mean by incongruous is I saw, you know, since she doesn't speak here, you have to go online. I saw an interview that she did with Michelle Norris on NPR in which she said, yeah. you know, was very much, you know, never again. She feels terrible about the U.S. decision-making during Rwanda and it'll never happen again. And, yeah. like, honestly, that's what people said then. It's like, we don't have the will or, you know, it's we just don't want to go. And so I'm not saying that it's easy to do something in Somalia, but it does, it seems incongruous to be saying on the one hand, we learned our lesson of being too hands-off while people were being slaughtered in Rwanda, but Somalia is terrible, but we better stay hands-off because we can't handle it. Like, what's the difference between the positions?
Yeah, I mean, it's not saying hands-off. I mean, it's like, I think it's making... Listen, like what do you propose? I mean, Matthew, you know, you bring this up a lot, but it seems like there is no excess of international will, of international support for invading, occupying, and staying in Somalia.
One thing is, maybe it's because for
decades, possibly.
Maybe it's because I hear too much from the Islamists. But I mean, the silence of the UN and the US and these well-meaning powers when the African Union peacekeepers, and I don't think they went there to like kill civilians, but I think like things have gotten so ugly there that there was this incident where a roadside bomb went off and then the Ugandan peacekeepers right. fired into the crowd. They killed 30 people, and the UN didn't say anything about it. In fact, what one of the countries said was, we asked Amisom, and they said they didn't do it. That's good enough for us. And that's outrageous. You know what I mean? I hate to, like, if right. the value of life is similar across the world, if this took place in Europe, if 30 people were killed by bullets by a force of authority, like, you have to do an investigation. You can't just say we took their word that they felt they were under fire. Even in Iraq, they looked into what Blackwater did, right? But this is sort of the one place on Earth where it's just like, because we just want to cross our fingers and hope Amazon works, you know? Then so yeah. we'll just, you know.
Well, listen, it's not only that. It's that I'm really. Skeptical that anything will sort of any foreign intervention mm-hmm. will work there.
But then stop propping up the. I mean, eventually Al Shabaab has, I guess, more certainly power on the ground. But there's been every attempt has been made to sort of like first it was like propping up the transitional federal government, which had very little support internally. Then everyone was happy mm-hmm. to see that the quote moderate wing of the Islamic courts went with them. But that's even, and again, you're kind of a captive to what you hear from, but I hear from a lot of people that are like, those guys are just like sellouts too. They were not maybe living in London when the fighting started, but now they want to move there, which is totally understandable. Yeah. But there's just very little connection between that government and not just Islamists, but like the street, which is why they keep getting like attacked every time they go anywhere.
So, you know, what's your solution?
I don't know.
Do you think there needs to be a full-on... Like I said earlier, a East Timor style nation building project where like a main Western country in East Timor's case, it was Australia, mm-hmm. leads an invading force and, you know, slowly builds up local governing capacity.
I don't know. I mean, I think again, I say this without. I guess you know, you see all this. You see this. It's pretty brutal what's going on there, right? And I think mm-hmm. I mean, maybe to be honest, maybe this is one where you have to kind of like. Go. You have to say like we're going to have a mostly Islamic peacekeeping force. Do you know what I mean? We're going to have, and I understand that there's a lot of vicissitudes, but there are clearly like the Ethiopians. This was not working, but it's going to take some unique approach. But all I'm saying is to say like we learned the lesson of Rwanda, but Somalia. What the hell? What can we do? The numbers aren't reaching, you know, but they continue to mount up, and it's sort of, and especially in a way. we may have the worst of both worlds, because if you're not willing, if you're for whatever not willing or able to go in to be kind of puppet mastering from the outside, setting up an unpopular government, and then when the, you know, the Amazon, they're receiving UN funds, when they fire into the crowd, you got to say something. When you're here's the other thing, I know you're, it's too easy to criticize, but the UN's main envoy to Somalia, Amadou Ould Abdallah, this is now 3 to 4 weeks ago that he said that reporters shouldn't report on the killing of civilians in Somalia because it stirs up hatred, as in Rwanda. And I want to say that not just did Human Rights Watch and like various press groups say that he should take it back or resign. I've talked to people on the 38th floor of the UN who said, oh, he's been told that was unacceptable. And the guy didn't have to take anything back. It's sort of like the UN has so few even like sort of like high-profile African diplomats that this guy can do, you know, he's off the script, let's put it that way. The thing that he said has been condemned by all sides, by journalists there, by, you know, and yet there, it's really kind of like a low point for the UN, where it's just like a pig in a poke. Like we cast, it was like when the Ethiopians were abusing people, the UN didn't say anything because they're like, well, we hoped that they would do the right thing. But I think that's why, at least, and again, you're always a captive, but that's, I mean, I agree. The people that I hear from there don't actually want any invading force. They're sort of, I guess, maybe that's what you're saying. It's sort of like, let them work it out. But if you're going to let them work it out,
well,
you can't
be I'm just saying that
propping up.
Oftentimes, you bring up Somalia, and you use Somalia sort of as a bludgeon to what you perceive maybe sometimes as sort of like activist community who's not calling for things calling who's not making Somalia a priority, or you use it as a bludgeon for the UN for not making anything better in Somalia. But the you know, this is, it seems like there is no easy solution. You know, I was trying to probe you earlier to get close to what you think a solution might look like, and the closest you came was a Muslim peacekeeping force.
And I think, I hate to say it, I don't think certainly the
right. You know, what does that mean, though? You know, can that happen? It doesn't seem like, you know, very likely.
No, you look around at UNMIL and all these other, there are a number of countries that have peacekeepers in places where they really, I hate to say it, they're not that much needed anymore, right? Sorry to say, but we have like these briefings on missions where it's like, I mean, every place needs something, but I'm saying this is, Somalia is a crisis.
I'm just saying, and I think that right now the UN is struggling to find peacekeepers for its most high profile mission in Darfur. Sure. It's only about 60% deployed, and you know Somalia is a much more complex environment. And
but
you
I
know,
but I hear that I don't really like, I don't like mean there, to there, there's no there, I just want to say having literally listened or seen the transcript of Susan Rice saying, I learned from Rwanda and we'll never again will we see that kind of carnage and do nothing. I don't know. You know, like, don't, maybe you can't do anything in Somalia, but then don't say that you learned the lesson, or, you know what I mean? I don't know.
The irony of this all is if you look at that Susan Rice transcript, she references Somalia to talk about why the U.S. government was incapacitated.
Mm-hmm. No, oh, I know, you're absolutely right. It's full circle.
Rwanda, you know, remember, totally. Rwanda happened, you know, a year after the Black Hawk Down incident. So everything having to do with like Africa and humanitarianism was seen through the Somalia prism, which was how, you know, which was obviously a mission gone bad.
Right, definitely.
So full circle. Mm-hmm.
Let me say, I think here's, and this is all hopefully right. Red meat for the activist community that you refer to. There was a briefing today by the Global Compact. Have you heard of it? It's the UN's entity.
Explain.
It's the UN's entity for engaging with the corporate community. It was started under Kofi Annan. Companies join it in order to sort of sign on without really any strings attached, without any really binding nature, but to pledge allegiance to 10 principles, three of which are human rights, there's labor rights, there's environmental, and there's now a 10th principle, which is anti-corruption. So today, there was a briefing, because they're having a two-day meeting of the implementation of Principle 10, meaning anti-corruption. And they brought a guy from Transparency International, and they also brought the chief compliance officer of BASF, and the leader of the head of the Global Compact, George Kell. This wasn't the purpose of telling the story, but BASF was in late 2008 accused of taking phosphate without permit or illegally from Western Sahara. So this issue arose and has yet to be answered in terms of them sort of being like the... I mean, there's things all over, but the high-profile thing right now with the Global Compact, which I think some of your... If I understand your activist community correctly, they know about, is PetroChina. PetroChina, this was many of the activist groups are extremely skeptical about the Global Compact and view it as kind of, you know, greenwashing or bluewashing. Like companies sign on, that's what they call it, and they don't have to change their behavior in any meaningful way. And what the UN always says is that, you know, or the Global Compact, they say, you know, it's an attempt to sort of share best practices. They're not an enforcement mechanism, but they have set up a complaint. They've tried to say, okay, if you really feel that someone who's joined has violated the principles, you can file a complaint. So in late 2008, some 80 NGOs filed a complaint about PetroChina and its engagement in Sudan, right down your alley. This complaint ended up, and this is where I think, you know, you may think like I'm like, why do they care about Darfur, not Sri Lanka? I mean, I think this was the idea, and the Global Compact Board, made up of corporate sort of corporate social responsibility bigwigs, and chaired by a guy called Mark Moody Stewart, the head of Anglo-American Mining, which does business in Zimbabwe, but has a very good and long reason, you know, reasoning and justification of it. They rejected the complaint against PetroChina. But these groups then wrote to all of the board members and sort of, you know, it's a pretty hooked up petition, and they're not saying that the company should even leave Sudan. They're saying it should, you know, engage with the government in these ways. So today it was said at this press conference that they're not reopening the complaint that was filed, but they're going to analyze their complaint mechanism and try, basically it's kind of like and off to the side, one of the Global Compact spokespeople tried to say, hey, we're trying to address this on the ground in Sudan, but it's kind of there was also, and I'm just I'm feel free to, I want to sort of there was a big thing here. It also seemed to me to be down your aisle, which was a day-long event on obscure tropical diseases, or maybe it's like rare.
Neglected.
There we go. Not obscure. Yes. I'm sorry. They're not obscure. People are dying. Neglected tropical diseases. And again, if they're neglected, then Bill Clinton coming and having a day about it is a good thing.
Yeah.
They offered sort of without any qualification praise for GlaxoSmithKline for saying that they're going to reduce some of their costs for some of these diseases. But, you know, again, Doctors Without Borders, to their credit, was like, okay, you're reducing costs on these, but what about HIV/AIDS drugs, which they're not reducing at all. So it was one of these kind of self-congratulatory, feel-good events. But maybe, you tell me, you may follow it more closer than me, maybe these once-neglected tropical diseases are being slayed by GlaxoSmithKline and Bill Clinton.
Honestly, I don't know very much about about the details. The whole idea of there being neglected tropical diseases is that oftentimes in sort of for the public health community in general and philanthropies specifically tend to focus sometimes too much on the big three of AIDS, TB, and malaria, and you know you have a host of other diseases that aren't AIDS, TB, or malaria, but are nonetheless, you know, devastating to some communities that also, you know, deserve some credit and some attention. So, I mean, that's like that's the whole genesis of there being sort of this phrase in the collective problem.
No, and I don't mean to be.
I don't know much about, you know, what specific companies are doing to combat them. But
I guess I seeing like this BASF thing and the Global Compact in general, I think sometimes the UN can be so kind of almost like so desperate to have kind of like corporate approbation that they offer unqualified praise when, you know, a mere Google search would say that, you know, that the praise should at least be qualified, you know? But, you know, again, it was one of these it's one of the things the UN does. Another thing the UN does is to, I don't know if you've seen this, is to it really came from the World Bank, but the UN sort of at least temporarily jumped on, was to jump on this call that 0.7% of various countries' bailouts or stimulus packages should be devoted to the poor, the MDGs, or, it seemed for a time, to the UN's budget. Have you heard of that one?
It's
circulating. Bob Zelig of the World Bank came out with it in an op-ed calling it a vulnerability fund, saying that with all, and in a way it's sort of, I mean, to me it's kind of, it, you understand why there's so many billions of dollars.
That hippie commie, right, Bob Zelig?
Say again?
The hippie commie.
I know. It's so strange, but the thing is that then there was this Times of London article saying UN, you know, very kind of tongue in cheek, like UN wants its share of the bailout. Right.
Well, that's the Times of London.
I understand, but you know what? I'm skipping a lot of steps because I understand it's a kind of a one-sided fight here. But
yeah.
Oh, that was the Times of London. But the reality was is that even later, you know, I ended up writing about it. It went on old Fox TV, your favorite, I'm sure. They very much wanted somebody to say
you made the big time.
Oh yeah, huh? No, I'm not. I think since one of our functions is media critique. They called up and said, do you want to talk about this article? And I'd seen the article. I was like, yeah, I'd like to say the poor need money. There's no question. Whether the UN regular budget is the right mechanism to get it to them, I'm not so sure. They said, let's check with our producers. Then they came back and they said, we really want to hear about the second point. So I was like, but I'm coming in with the first point too, I definitely know people that would say if it's Fox, it's just, you know, but the reality is, the thing is that where is the liberal TV station that wants to like promote that idea? What you have is a bunch of unaccountable do-gooders. I mean, I got an angry call from something called the Millennium Campaign, which is, I'd always thought is part of the UN. Have you ever heard of them? The Millennium Campaign. The UN Millennium Campaign. It sounds like they're doing God's work.
It sounds
UN-y. They called from a UNDP number. The previous head of the Millennium Campaign was a woman called Evelyn Hershkins, the Dutch diplomat that ended up having to be fired because she was taking money for a penthouse in New York while working for the UN. But they called me and said, we're not the UN. Don't ascribe that 0.7 to us because we don't speak for the UN. And then the question is, like, then why is UN in your name? I know this is... I'm sorry, but I guess what I want to say is...
But wait, wasn't Robert Zoellick, who is the World Bank president, the one making?
No, he wrote the op-ed, and then there were various articles, not only in the Times of London, saying that at the recent G7 meeting in Rome, you know, the one where the Japanese finance minister was all boozed up and had to quit, that the staff of the UN Millennium Campaign were working the halls. I mean, I guess I look on it. Here's the thing, and I'm trying to find a way to engage on this, and the idea is that. Mm-hmm. I love the model of, like, you know, there are these global bureaucrats, and then there's, like, civil society trying to get their ear, right? Like, in the past, it might have been with, like smoke bombs and, like, you know, black masks and camps outside Davos. But now civil society has been invited in. They're, like, on the fringes, what do they call it? On the margins of the G7. You have Bono, and you have, you know, whatever you have over there. But the thing is that I've come to understand that part of that seeming civil society margin is actually the UN itself. You have this irony of the UN lobbying itself, right? I mean, like, the UN Millennium Campaign, I don't think that's civil society. That sounds like a UN agency to me. I'm not saying that they shouldn't, but then if they have a report, make a report and stand behind it. But they're sort of, the way it's reported is kind of like UN Millennium Campaign, you know, activists are lobbying the G7. And I mean, screw the G7, but there needs to be some, you should be able to know who's who. And when you hear civil society, it shouldn't be the UN itself. Do you know what I mean? I'm sorry. I don't mean to be curmudgeonly. I'm sure. I couldn't. You know, it's sometimes this foreign policy stuff is. And a final outrage taking place is that the UN Development Program, the jewel of the UN system in terms of engaging with poverty and development, needs a new director. Kamal Dervis is resigning at the end of this month. In days. So under Kofi Annan, bless him, when they made the selection of Kamal Dervis, the whole process was public. They listed five names. They said they were being interviewed, and then they said Kamal Dervis wins. Ad Melker came in second, and he became the associate. This time, although there's some, Helen Clark, for example, of New Zealand, has said she's a candidate and was interviewed. The UN has refused to produce any short list. And so I asked.
And who does the naming?
It's Ban Ki-moon.
Is it the Secretary General, or is it the Executive
Board? No, it's Ban Ki-moon. Interestingly
UNDP.
Enough, I know that the UNDP is actually run by the Executive Board on a day-to-day basis, but the nomination of the head of UNDP is done by the Secretary General, and then is, you know, it's like advise and consent, and then is confirmed by the Executive Board. So they admit that it's Ban Ki-moon's choice, but they've said, what they've tried to say is, it seems strange, because obviously Ban Ki-moon said he's going to be very transparent, right? This is not transparent.
Yeah.
And their reasoning is that there may be candidates that don't want it to be known that they're running because they don't want to lose. And okay, everyone has thin skin, right? But I mean, at this level, it seems pretty lame, right? In most things, like, I mean, I don't know why, this idea of like, produce the short list, say what the qualifications are, right? I don't know. So so this has been a sort of a we've hit the end of we've hit, you know, pushed transparency as far as it can go. But the dispute seems to be whether it will once again be a Westerner or Nordic, or whether it may go to a developing world person. And, you know, watch this site.
And where is the current, where is Kamal Dervis?
Oh, he's from Turkey. He's from Turkey. So that was the first time. It had been an American post for a long time. And then it was Mark Malik Brown of the UK. And then it was Kamal Dervis. So what nobody knows, actually, this may then pique your interest. Some people are saying, although the U.S. name is not known, that now with Obama in, with Obama wanting to engage with the U.N., although he still hasn't come here, by the way, and may not come for some time, but, you know, having a cabinet-level ambassador and speaking a lot about multilateralism, that this, you know, they got to get something. They want to have a higher profile at the U.N., you know? So whether being the getting the top post of UNDP is high profile enough, or whether they might actually want the DSG's job, nobody quite knows. The executive board of UNDP is actually chaired right now by Iran, so it would be an interesting.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but probably the highest ranking U.S. official in the UN system is
Lynn Pascoe,
who's the head of the UN political affairs.
That's him, exactly. And I'm not saying he's not high profile, but
that's like the highest political office. I mean, it's sort of like the UN State Department.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
That's kind of how. Although,
you know,
described.
What's funny is that in terms of actual impact, the head of peacekeeping may have more impact, because he actually runs places where the UN really has a say. I mean, Lynn Pascoe is kind of relegated to not relegated. I mean, I'm sure like a place like Gaza, they have UNRWA, but they also have, you know what I mean? But often the department that he heads, DPA, is sort of viewed as kind of, they deal with places where peacekeeping isn't, you know, like they dealt with Turkmenistan and opened an office there. They've definitely been working on the Sri Lanka, you know, where they call it the file, the Sri Lanka file.
Yeah.
You know, so I agree. It's not that, but the thing is that he.
So interesting. So when do you think we'll know if we'll have.
Whether the U.S. gets a UNDP post?
Whether have a UNDP administrator, Caroline Kennedy.
You've got very good intuition. My bet is that she may well. She's one of the names being thought of as the next UNICEF, head of UNICEF, which is currently held by an American, mm-hmm. Ann Benneman. But most people say when her term is up, she's out. And she's a Hillary. There's a lot of, you know, this is always. I don't get into the scuttlebutt, Mark, believe it or not. But the scuttlebutt is Hillary is very much looking at the UNICEF post more than the UNDP one. You know. And I'm not sure if Carolyn Kennedy.
Hillary, you mean Carolyn?
No, I
Kennedy.
Mean Hillary. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, has. There's a lot of scuttlebutt about who's really running the UN, the U.S.'s engagement with the UN. I mean, obviously, technically, you know, Susan Rice is the ambassador, Hillary Clinton's the Secretary of State, but on a thing like who does the U.S. want to head UNICEF, I'm told that Miss Hillary Clinton is going to pull the trigger on that one. And so, those who dine in Chappaqua may soon, you know. Be a three UN plaza.
Sorry, I thought you were saying that like there's rumor that Hillary Clinton.
No, not at all. I was saying she hasn't.
Bizarre.
No, absolutely. Okay. Don't. I'm not that far gone, Mark. Is that she may well have Carolyn Kennedy in mind for that post.
All right.
There
so
you
we'll
go.
See.
I don't like the sort of like page six, political coverage of the UN, but.
Cool. Well, until next
all
time
right, then. Definitely.
We'll have to see. Thanks, Matthew.